Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Jason Ben-Levy, has spent the past 25 years as a marketing communications guru working with the leading technology companies in Silicon Valley. He's seen what goes on behind the scenes, and he believes technology is changing the way we behave, who will benefit from this transformation, and how it is more driven by financial concerns than by scientific advancement. He writes about this in his new book, Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. He believes that developing technology takes a lot of money, and wealthy investors have the cash, and as history reveals, what is good for capital is often at odds with what is good for humanity in general. He writes, quote, "Fortunately, you can choose between living in a digital dream or digital dread by understanding what is taking place behind the hype and spin. Above all, remember this. For the time being, at least, you are in control. Almost everything has an off switch or a plug you can pull. Don't be afraid to pull it if you don't like what you see." Jason Ben-Levy has worked at many of the world's leading technology companies. He's blogged under many aliases about culture and technology. His bio says, Now that he has summoned the courage and recklessness to put a name to his work, he's put an end to his career. And Jason joins us in studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did you really put an end to your career?
No, I'm actually still working in the industry.
So it's nice to meet you in person because we're Facebook friends.
We are
and I feel
indeed.
Like I kind of know you because we have this sort of online relationship.
That's true.
Which is really funny considering we're talking about the motivation behind some of these companies. So why don't you talk a little bit about your 25 years as a marketer?
Sure.
What did you really experience? Who did you come in contact with? Okay. What did you see behind the scenes?
Well, part of it is really, I came into it as one of these people who was kind of like Steve Jobs, kind of living in both worlds, like being technical and at the same time being creative and trying to figure out where I fit in all this. And in the beginning, we really liked personal computing because it gave us the ability to use all this technology that had previously just been reserved for the military and for big businesses. And pretty much it unleashed a whole new wave of creativity, and people around it were brilliant folks. And I loved being part of that world and helping them do, even though I wasn't the world's greatest technologist, I certainly understood it. And I helped them communicate that to the rest of the world. And so the idea was that we were empowering people to do things. People could start their own business using a personal computer. The Mac made that a whole quantum leap easier for people who are creative folks to use a computer. And we started on this wonderful pathway of giving people a tool to extend what they're able to do, as it's been called, you know, the bicycle for the mind. And it was a wonderful thing. But then it started changing along the way. And the change really started in the 1990s when the internet came along. And even though the internet had been around for 20 years before that, the World Wide Web, which was originally created as a project for CERN to help scientists share information, it turned out that it was good for sharing other things that were really more helpful to businesses than necessarily to us.
And, okay, so elaborate on that.
Sure.
I mean, what were the major changes that you saw once the internet came to be?
Sure. I think there was a huge cultural change, even in the people who would be down in the valley or in venture capital and whatever. Before that, a lot of the people who started venture capital were actually scientists. Kleiner of Kleiner Perkins was a scientist from the Bell Labs. Who wanted to start a company, and through his uncle, found the funding to start his own company because banks wouldn't give them the money. And then that started funding other science-oriented people. But during the 90s, we had a whole class that would have gone to Procter & Gamble before, who were just marketers and people who could really not care less about the technology. And they just looked at it as a big storefront, and trying to figure out what they can do to kind of move everything through the storefront. And that's where we saw that explosion of brands during the dot-com era, where people would go and say, I've established a brand. And yet they didn't really have any product. I mean, it was all about marketing and not really much substance. And so we started moving to a different class of people working the internet, that it moved away from being the people who are really interested in science and education and knowledge sharing to being people who are out to just try and sell something.
And one of the main messages in your book is that we really need to look at the motivations behind the people running these companies.
It's absolutely true. When we think about Facebook, we have to remember that we are not the customer, that we're actually the product. That what we're being profiled and our information is being sold off to advertisers. And some people say, well, that's great. I actually like that because that way I can have ads directed at me that are just the ones I want. Well, that's kind of a bizarre view because you kind of remove all the ambient experience of life. If you a good analog would be if you looked at a newspaper. When you're reading a newspaper, you have all these articles in front of you. You may have 10 articles in front of you, and through this randomness, you kind of pick what you want to read. And you're exposed to things that you wouldn't be exposed to necessarily otherwise because it's not in your profile of interest. But if you've, once you've established a profile of interest, you're only going to have things directed at you that someone has determined that you are interested in.
Now, what's interesting, too, is we've done so many shows about privacy. Is Google making us stupid? What effect is this having on our brains? And you come at this from a completely different perspective because you're writing about, again, the motivations behind these companies and saying that they have such a cult following and we don't spend enough time saying, well, why are they really providing this service to us at no cost that we don't physically give them dollars?
No, we don't.
But you've got, for example, I'm just looking here, Facebook value actually slips to $98 billion in private trading.
Right. Right.
So what questions do you think we need to be asking, those of us who use this technology and sort of feel like, well, I'm not really paying them. I might click on something once in a while, and they're doing this. They're putting this out there because they believe that information should be free to everyone.
Right. Well, you know, the information being free is kind of an interesting argument in itself. But I think that what's really happening is that when we think about social networking, it really, as an example, it really responds to a human need. It's very seductive because we are all living so far from each other. We all have long histories of friendships of people that we've kind of lost contact with. And we like Facebook because it gives us this kind of postcard kind of ability to communicate with people. Now, when we talk with them on the phone, that it, you know, there's a certain effort involved, and certainly no one's writing letters. And even an email, we've kind of treated it as spam. So what we like about Facebook is that it's this really easy way for people just to give each other a little bit of information and keep each other current. So we like social networking. It's a good, positive human need that's being met. But that's the seductiveness of it, because it is so in tune with what we are as social beings that we kind of are willing to put out a ridiculous amount of information about ourselves, personal information, that is being shared both internally among, you know, other people you know, and you know can at times shame yourself saying things. But even if you write a message to someone and you think you're writing a private message to someone, that private message is being sifted through for keywords that are used to market products. Someone recently sent me a note about some illness that they were having, and I responded back to it. And this was a private email. This wasn't on the public page. And I started getting ads about that particular disease because it somehow sifted that because I had used that keyword in a private conversation that was, you know, intended for me.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, again, we don't want to be sifted and turned into, you know, just mere fodder for advertisers. And again, it's exploiting that social part of us. And I fundamentally think that there's a conflict between being social and being commercial, and that probably the best idea for us to look forward in doing a social network is to have an open system that is a public domain system that's basically just like when you use a web browser, no one said this is the only company web browser you can use, that there's kind of a standard for everybody and people can communicate. And if we did a social networking that was not owned by one company that was busy sifting through our information, it would be a definite benefit for everybody.
In his new book, Too Much Magic, Jason Ben-Levy writes, even Google, which provides a great service, is entirely financed by selling ad space. All of this Silicon Valley talent and brain power is concentrated on placing ads more effectively. It seems like an awful waste of intelligence when we have so many difficult problems in our world that the power of technology could help solve.
Well said.
So you think that this is a waste of intelligence and a waste of
time? I think it absolutely is. When we think about that how much attention is being focused, it's just to... We've gone through this thing where we invented these phenomenal interactive tools. To be able to use a computer is an amazing thing, and the fact that they get smaller all the time is wonderful and cheaper. But we're treating it as if it's a television. And that it literally is turning into a television where we're watching our film clips on there, and they have little ads that roll into it. And now they can target those ads even more tightly to you because they have a profile of you. And so we wind up, again, with this continual storefront that we're being marketed all the time. And you know, even if you think about the space program, you know, how much, if you think about even just in video gaming, how much money is spent on video gaming in a year, and how much of that is space fantasy, how much are we spending on space programs anymore and getting anything done? For the first time in 30, 40 years, actually even more than that, we have no human space flight program in the United States. And I think with all the brain power that we find in Silicon Valley, that people can't find solutions to conquer space flight in some innovative way is really kind of shameful.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners on this. What are your thoughts about Jason's argument that we need to spend more time looking at the motivations behind these companies and the people that run companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google? Do you agree that we sort of think that they're giving us this service because they believe in free information and sort of creating a better world? I worked in tech in the 90s and everybody said, we're changing the world. Well, what has really changed? We'd love to hear from you. 866.
This is a rebroadcast. Please, no calls.
Have concerns about who controls your digital technology. And if you work in Silicon Valley or you work in technology, what do you think about Jason's argument that so much brain power is being wasted on this focus on making revenue from advertising or maybe even coming up with all of these different apps that we're seeing on a regular basis? And we've got a caller on ads. So let's hear from Peter in Watsonville. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I must say, first of all, I thoroughly enjoy your show, and thank your guests for turning up.
Thank you.
I think what's going to happen is that all data mining is going to have to be banned because, as your guest said, once you start to get into medical problems, you start to get into sifting for insurance companies. I know that if I'm looking for tires on the Internet the next week or so, I see nothing but tire ads. If somebody's paid Google a tremendous amount of money to sell tires, then they'll get their ad put in front of someone that may be useful for me. And the reason I think that all ad sifting, or rather data mining, has to be banned is because if you go back to the medical thing I mentioned, that when insurance companies were made to pay back a certain amount of the premiums paid to the people paying them over a certain amount, all the insurance companies did was to go out and buy hospitals. So they shift the cost from one book to another. The corporations are always ahead of the law, so there's no two ways about it. So the only way of actually stopping the abuse on this is to physically stop the system. No data mining, no storage, and just put a block on it. And I'd be welcome to hear your guest's opinion on that.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Peter. So I'm at my Facebook page right now.
Okay.
And the ads I'm seeing are Emily's List, pro-family, pro-health, pro-choice.
Uh-huh.
And just about 2 hours ago, I put an image on my page. The Republicans are having a hearing on birth control this morning,
right,
and all of the panelists are men. So I put a photo on my page about that. There I got the pro-family
That's
ad.
Right.
And then I have an ad for veganism.
Okay.
I'm a vegan. And then I have an ad for arts and culture in San Francisco.
Right.
So a lot of people would say, well, this is innocuous. What's the big deal?
Well, I think the problem, again, is this narrowing that starts taking place, and that you are being typed as only being interested in those things, for one thing. You are losing the other ambient experiences that you would get, again, if you were using a newspaper or a magazine and you'd open it up and there'd be more experience for you. But, you know, there's ways of dealing with this, which is that, as an example, on Facebook, if you really want to stop getting profiled, start confusing them. Start clicking on the things that you're not interested in. And don't click on the ones that you are.
So go to a Rick Santorum page, for example?
That's right. Actually, go to a Rick Santorum page and start kind of screwing with them a little bit. And then also, if you see something that you're really interested in, don't click on it, because you can go and just go to that web address for whatever it is, and you can save whatever organization is advertising to you. You can save them the per-click fee by just going directly to their site.
So I guess the bigger question is, what are they doing with this information? So they know that I'm pro-choice and I'm a vegan and I like
right.
arts.
Okay.
So what are they doing with that?
Well, the problem is we don't know eventually what happens with all this information, because all the information is persistent. That is, 20 years from now, someone could be looking at this profile of you for some particular reason. If we think about the McCarthy era, as an example, they went back to, you know, Communist Party records from the 1930s and were deciding who could work in Hollywood and who couldn't. And if we start assembling these very large data sets where everyone is predefined, say you're looking for a job 10 years from now and someone who just has some personal animus against veganism says, I'm not going to hire that person. They were a vegan. And you wind up with this kind of profile that's persistent. And again, none of this information ever goes away. Hmm. And when Facebook eventually goes out of business, which it will, what happens to all the information that they have gathered about you? Who owns it?
I guess on a more serious note, the example you brought up earlier about looking for your friend's medical issue, or if you're taking a prescription drug, or if you have pre-existing conditions, if you smoke, for example.
Right.
If you're divorced, I mean, mm-hmm. anything like that,
right.
That really could be used.
Right, and it doesn't just, it's not just when you're using the net, it's also when you're using your, say, Safeway card. Mm-hmm. That's every swipe that you're doing of that card sends information to a database that creates a profile.
You know, I reported on this in the late 90s, and do you have specific examples of how this information was used negatively against people?
This is still a gathering database that people right now, what'll happen is the next time you go to the store, you'll get a coupon for something similar to what you had before. But there is nothing limiting them from selling that information farther down the line to someone else. There are no laws about any of this information sharing. That is that we've had a lot of legal framework that's happened in the last 15 years of the internet to protect content providers. Or movie studios or record companies, we have had not one bit of legislation to protect the privacy of citizens.
Let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Dennis in Santa Cruz. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having this wonderful guest on your show. I say amen to everything that's been said, and these points need to be brought up. People need to listen to all this sort of thing. And it's not the mere paranoia about privacy, but the fact that everyone's interest is being limited by their social media and the interest history. It does affect our democracy, and people do not realize that this unwitting change is occurring in our democracy. It's a frightening thing, and the real discussions, substantive discussions that need to be occurring in our country are not happening because people are being really taken advantage of by these internet phenomena, and their interest is, and their time is being diverted from the things that really need to be considered.
And so, Dennis, let me ask you, how do you think this is affecting our democracy?
By virtue of what our speaker has alluded to, people divert themselves instead of becoming involved with others in a constructive way. They're diverted with gaming, social networking, and the way our society is structured now is less interactive on a personal level, and that's a real problem. So I'm just glad that these points are being raised in public, and hopefully people will start thinking about this. I abjure from all social media, and I do not wish to be profiled, and everything that's been said in this program today is of grave concern to me. Mm-hmm. And we do not have a right of privacy enshrined in our Constitution. It's implied but not written. And everyone has value. If you would say that a woman can share her body with anyone else, there would be horror. Yet our information is as sacred as a woman's person.
Well,
and no one is considering this.
Thank you for calling in, Dennis. We have an email from Cheryl who says, data mining is the beginning of Big Brother. The thought of the government using this technology will create a very controlled society where individual freedom of choice has no place if you don't agree with them. Very scary.
What's interesting in this is that it has already happened, but it wasn't government. That is that all of this stuff has been happening under private auspices, that most of the data mining has not been by the government. In fact, the government goes to the private companies in order to get the data. That after the World Trade Center bombings, what became Homeland Security wound up going to a private data mining company in Arkansas and basically backed up the truck and downloaded the files in order to get information to sift through, and that there were other companies that had basically been sifting through this data before. And, you know, right now we could say, gee, we're going after terrorists, so that's good. They were able to find the terrorists through that. But who winds up being on the list of enemies farther down the road? Is it you or me, because we didn't back the Republican Party in 2000 and, or 2010 or 2012? Again, once you have that profiling up on your Facebook page, you know, people know who you are, or at least people in power know who you are.
And do you think part of the problem is that they're, like you say, pulling the plug on the cult of technology, that a lot of these companies have a cult-like following? And, you know, a lot of the founders of these companies are young men, and people sort of look up to that. And as you write, the Valley itself has morphed from a collection of brilliant, curious people in love with science and tech into a collection of bankers who are motivated by the prospect of building ridiculous wealth overnight. And in this country, obviously, Fortune magazine, the top 500 wealthiest people, they're put on these pedestals.
Right.
Apple has a very cult-like following. I always see the Apple stickers on Priuses.
Right.
So do you think that's part of it?
I think those two are probably a little bit different from each other. I think that what happened with Apple, that it was really the kind of a grassroots kind of thing, that even when Apple was going, you know, down the tubes, there were hardcore people who were Apple users, and there's something, there's a why behind Apple that makes it work differently than other companies. And it's kind of ironic that they wound up becoming the big dog at the moment. But in reality, most of, I don't think the motivation behind Apple originally was to make a lot of money. I think it was about giving people the power to use computers in a simple way. And I think that was good. But I think the change now is that there are, again, we have this change in class of the people doing this. And basically we have this ecosystem where we have literally the same people who were responsible for, you could go down the who's who of the dot-com era who were financing it, the mortgage crisis, and now the current IPOs of companies that are coming on, including Facebook, and you'll find exactly the same firms.
Because Goldman Sachs is behind the Facebook
among
IPO,
others,
right?
That Goldman Sachs is one of the players, but you'll find almost all the other players are also banks that have been bailed out.
So you're seeing a lot of overlap.
There's a lot of overlap. And well, you know, often the scions of families that didn't want to go into banking back in Boston or in New York moved to Silicon Valley, moved to Sand Hill Road, and set up shop as private capital, venture capitalists, and are funding these companies. And they reflect their political views.
Well, I would love to hear from people who work in Silicon Valley or work in technology. What do you think about Jason Ben-Levy's arguments that we need to look at the motivations behind the people not only running these companies, but the people that are funding these companies? The toll-free number is
866-798-8255.
He says these venture capitalists are using digital magic to distract us, invade our privacy, corrupt our democracy, and distort our human values. Do you think he's going too far, or do you agree with his overall argument? We're talking with Jason Ben-Levy, author of Too Much Magic. We'll be back after this.
KALW has been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial in the Bay Area since 1941. Now, with online listening, KALW has listeners worldwide. But just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean KALW's online streams aren't for you. If you hear KALW at work but not at home, or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at KALW.org. Whether you're on your desktop, your tablet, your smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment about the show there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Jason Benlevy. He spent 25 years as a marketing communications guru working with the leading technology companies in Silicon Valley. At the time, he blogged under an alias. He decided to go public with what he saw behind the scenes and his views in a new book called Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And his main argument is that while we, so many of us, enjoy all of this technology, we really need to spend more time talking about the motivations behind the people running these companies and the people funding these companies. And you can join us at 866.
This is a rebroadcast. Please, no calls.
Also
thank you.
A comment at yourcallradio.org. And we'll get you to kind of elaborate on the funding, because mm-hmm. that's really interesting, but we have full lines, so
okay,
let's go
great.
To a few callers. Let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I feel so left out. Nobody's sending me anything about anything, and I do Google a lot about diseases for friends, etc. And in the old days, AOL, I still have an AOL account, but I don't use it, and I check it once in a while. Now they're sending me Christian stuff. It's Christian singles. I don't understand that, but since I'm neither. Anyway, I don't get it.
We can be happy when they get it wrong.
Yeah, well, I think it's the garbage approach. You know, someone's out there, and let's just try this. But I don't get any ads, and I guess, is it because I'm not on Facebook?
Oh, now, when you go and use a web page, when you use a web browser, do you see no ads when you're using a web browser?
Yeah, I guess I do, but it doesn't even occur to me to look at them. I mean, it's... you know, the things that are flashing off to the side, is that it?
Right, those would be the ads.
You know, like I do Google.
Right.
And then, as you say, what you've mentioned, I don't click. I go to the website of the person,
okay.
you know, of the organization. And the reason I don't do Facebook, you know, a gazillion years ago when, you know, 3 years ago, whenever it started, they had all these terms, and it said, when you sign up for it, you're giving yourself up to it. I mean, they said we're going to sell you, we're going to market you, we can use you any way we want, and we say, okay.
Yeah, in fact, we don't even read the agreements, and the agreements are written in a way that we're never going to read them.
I know, but I read them.
Well, you may be the only person who did.
Well, there you are. Come to me if you need some legal advice.
Well, you know, but I think that's by design. I think that they instead of giving you a simple agreement as to what you're signing on for, mm-hmm. They give us pages and pages, so that way we just go and click the box at the bottom and never bother reading it.
Will that change with the new? I know the financial reform thing is so different, another world. However, that was all about simplifying contracts, mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. Is there any kind of movement afoot to simplify this? Because truly, you're just sheep coming. You know, we are just sheep coming in, saying, "Use me." If you sign up for these things and you don't read it.
Right. I'd have to say that the idea of getting any of the technology companies corralled to coming up with a simpler agreement isn't going to happen anytime soon, because there's really no political interest in it in Washington. That is that Barack Obama sits down with Mark Zuckerberg, he's not going to be saying, you know, Mark, we got to go and clean up this Privacy Act thing.
Right.
On the other side of it, you know, obviously they're interested in making money on the Republican side. And so there really is no advocate in either party that's on our side on this.
May I ask, though, for both of you, because you have gone on Facebook, obviously you must. Do you feel what you get out of it is worth seeing the ads and being sold to other marketers?
Well, I try to be pretty careful about the information that I put up there. So I knew right at the beginning that everything is, you know, anything that goes on the net is there forever. And one way or another is either public or shared among people who I don't necessarily want it shared with. So I tended to be pretty cautious with what was up there. But, you know, I regularly, blog about or post about technology and politics. So it would be pretty easy to tell what I'm about from that profile. And I'm not shameful about that part anymore. I'm fine being, you know, being noted as a progressive and being friendly toward technology, but not necessarily toward all technology companies.
Thanks for calling in, Ruby. kudos for you for training your eyes not to look at those ads, because a lot of people don't see them. They're there, but they don't see them.
Well, that's the folks who've done advertising research for years say that even when you think you're not seeing them, you're seeing them.
All right, well, let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Carlisle in Carmel Valley. Hi, Carlisle. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I saw a great film. I don't know if you're aware of it. It was at the Palo Alto International Film Festival, and it was called The Real Revolutionaries, and it's actually put out by Intel. Very revealing about the history of all this technology and the hook-in of being funded by the military-industrial complex at the same time when you had Mario Savio and everybody in Berkeley, and almost these two competing thought movements. One was humanists and one was science, and their lack of intersection. I think it's a great show, and I like the way you guys are discussing it, and it's called The Real Revolutionaries, and even though it's put out by Intel, it's amazing.
Let me respond to that. What's really interesting is that at almost at the same time that actions were going on at UC Berkeley, at UCLA is where the internet was being born. That's where the first internet technologies were tried, and they were under the auspices of the Defense Department.
Right, and that's why they have the big funding. They're so far ahead. We're playing catch up. It's like really democratic, but meanwhile they took over the whole economy. So we're all trying to play catch up. But yeah, it was big in the San Francisco Bay Area, though, with these transistor guys too.
Right.
I mean, it's all, you know. Anyway, I'll get out there and I'll let you talk. Have a good time.
All right, thank you for calling in, Carlisle. Let's hear next from Aaron in San Francisco. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks. I wanted to hopefully build upon a question you asked a little earlier in the show, and in speaking with a caller before the break, you asked about the impact of these technologies, and I think you may have specified social media on our democracy. And I have a couple of thoughts on that. The first is, which I think you guys have already mentioned a couple different times, kind of the customization of advertising based on your interest and patterns of behavior. And I think that's fairly easy to see how, if you just translate that into, political affiliations and even in many cases actual advertisements for a candidate, for a particular organization, that has a specific cause. I think it's fairly easy to see how that falls into this narrative that you guys have articulated very well about kind of narrowing somebody's point of view, and it creates kind of an echo chamber effect. So I think that's one major way that, and I think that's, I personally think that that's not a good thing. I think that just kind of contributes to the whole cacophony of people kind of sitting around telling each other how right they are and how wrong the other side is, but not actually having conversations. And then I think, in my opinion, related to that is that the manner of discourse, I'm thinking primarily of Facebook, and I understand Facebook enough to know how it works. I deactivated my account like a year or so ago, and I felt like just much less distracted since then. But I've seen enough to have like a pretty informed opinion of how Facebook and Twitter work for individual users. And I remember seeing, particularly on Facebook, and I think you see the same kind of thing on like newspaper websites in the comment section after articles, you see the same dynamic. But you'll see somebody put out an idea, well, I think this, or I read this article and it's right. And that's fine. But then the chain of responses, following the post or following the article, just become these kind of sniping back and forth, and people citing things, or, you know, or saying, well, that person, you know, this person's an idiot and that person's right. And like, it's just not, I think, no matter what your point of view is, it's just, I think it's not hard to see how that's not really, that's not actual discourse. That's not actually engaging with ideas, and it's certainly not listening. And I just think it's like I know that there's no stopping it at this point.
Well, you know, you made a good point about the echo chamber. We have an email that's similar to that by Doug, who says, what worries me even more than the customization of the product selling experience is the similar customization of the political information flow. For example, he says, if my news supplier knows that I am anti-choice or thinks it knows, it can constrain my news to articles that promote that viewpoint and never let me see rational arguments that might change my mind. In this way, I will perceive this to be a good news source, which provides value to me as a consumer. He writes, your guest spoke of this issue with respect to product marketing, but again, I feel that a deeper concern is that of political thought.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Again, it's the same technology and it's already happening. And even, you know, what you would search for on Google based on your profile and what you've searched for before would be different than what I would get. So it's not an objective result anymore. It's a result of what you have put in your history. And even though Google claims to anonymize the data after a certain point, there's no way of ever verifying that that's true.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. Thank you for the email. And we're speaking with Jason Benlevy. He spent 25 years in marketing in some of Silicon Valley's largest companies, and he's out with a book called Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. We have full lines. We'll have one open in a couple minutes.
No calls, please. This is a rebroadcast. No calls. Thank you.
Radio.org, or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Christopher in Santa Monica. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I love this conversation. This is a conversation we need to have throughout the country, everywhere, all the time, because you know, I use technology quite a bit. I mean, I also have a degree in technology, related degree. And you know, being that I'm on both sides of the paradigm, because I'm a user and also helped develop some of this stuff years ago, you know, it's all about money. And really, in my opinion, since the late 90s, it all became about money. And I agree with Jason and the number of the callers. But, you know, one thing I will say is it's not just technology per se, the Internet, or ARPANET, if you want to go way back. But it's not just a matter of the Internet. Or Google, or you know, any other particular corporation. It's really a society issue, because you know, the same thing is happening in film,
right?
Motion pictures. Oh, it's a marketing thing. It's not about quality scripts or stories. It's not about a lot of things that used to be about, or possibly could be.
Right.
It's primarily a marketing tool, and the same with news on TV and TV shows and
right.
demographics. Well, it's all marketing.
Right. And actually, let me jump in on that one, which is that the book actually goes into other areas, too. It's not just about the Internet. And there's a huge chapter about movie making and CG, and how the same tools that are used for CG, which, you know, we all have different opinions about CG. I think it's kind of like a way of, like, you know, covering a story that isn't very good usually.
Right.
But we're finding that those same tools are available for working the news. That is, that what we see on the news, there's no necessary, there's no necessity that what we're looking at is reality anymore.
Exactly.
And we've already seen some live inserted shots that were used. The most famous one was Dan Rather in Times Square with the CBS logo behind him, which was supposedly on the big Jumbotron screen. But in reality, if you were there, that wasn't on the screen. That was a live insert. And that the temptation to go and change what we're looking at on screen, on the news, and give people a false impression is really overwhelming. And because these tools are getting cheaper and easier to use, we can't really expect that the picture is truth anymore.
Exactly. Well, one more thing I'd like to just say is that you know, a lot of this is a polarization, whether it's you know, it's obviously based and rooted in the marketing, which is based in the finance side of it, but it's also polarization of America. Whether it's Democrat or Republic, or whether it's this or that. And it's a lot easier to
define people and therefore create a certain type of society in the future by polarizing, and, you know, because it limits the thinking. It limits everything about the society eventually, I think.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Christopher. And I want to read a couple emails. We have a lot of emails. Nicole says, I'm using digital technology now, streaming your show live on my MacBook while I paint my kitchen. Hi, Nicole. And the internet, she says, can be used to share information in both directions, the paradox of living in the technological age. By the way, I recently discovered that my Google profile says I'm an 18 to 24-year-old male, but in reality, I'm a 40-year-old woman. Perhaps their data mining process isn't too perfect, or I am simply not very easy to demographic.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that's good. I'm glad that you're able to kind of throw them off, unless someone else who is 18 years old is using your computer. In which case, that is picking up that information instead.
And Ralph writes, today's program reminds me of Jerry Manner's book, In the Absence of the Sacred, that we need a greater social discourse to uncover consequences of technologies and then decide how to move forward. If only the culture can make such a practice.
That's true. Oh, actually, Jerry Manner is kind of an inspiration to that, and the elimination of arguments for elimination of television, too. So, yes, I agree.
Well, thank you for those emails, and let's go through a couple calls, and then we'll get responses from Jason. Let's hear from Shan in San Francisco. Hi, Shan.
Oh, you're my favorite, and Jason, I think he's delivering the golden fleece or something. I love this. Now, here's what I wrote a while back, and I objected immediately to when they were playing with the channels of TV, the box and the HP, and I just refused to go for it. But here's my little two or three lines. As an itinerant poet and an elder, I want to share. I don't tweet. I don't Twitter. Shall I repeat? I don't tweet. I don't Twitter. I don't Facebook either. I'd much rather sit beside you and share a cappuccino.
Well, that's actually really interesting. I'm glad that you had that poem because, one of the things that you really notice a lot about social interaction, and I'm a longtime cafe hangout person, that we moved from people having random conversations in cafes because they were sitting across the table from each other, had to share a table, and now everybody has the laptop across from each other, and no one talks anymore.
Yep.
And there's a really terrific cafe that I love to go to in San Francisco, but I've never heard anybody talk in this place. And it's all laptops.
I heard there's a cafe in Berkeley that actually prevents this because they want people to interact.
Right. Actually, that's even in my book. It may be Emeryville, but it's right around the cusp of those two towns, and they purposely do not have that. They also have analog turntables, too, for the real throwbacks.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Shan. I loved your poem. We'd love to have tea with you. Let's go next to Mike, who's calling from On the Road. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm actually just pulling off the road here, okay? One of the things, this is a great show, one of the things that is different about this issue that we don't normally think about is that when we think of information and how it's controlled, we think of the government, but this is privately owned information, and when we get into these, we no longer can control where that information goes.
That's correct.
And this is such a different paradigm from what we're used to. It bothers me. The exact fix for it, I can't exactly think, but I have a Facebook page that I really don't go to much and I'm probably going to back out of. I got it because my daughter got on Facebook and I was concerned what she was doing. But the amount of information, you know, when I'm clicking to figure out about an issue that people could get and that people can own and then people could sell to, you know, political enemies that might have an economic interest in getting rid of their political enemies, this really bothers me. Are there people who are thinking about possible laws, possible constitutional changes?
The problem is that this is not on anybody's agenda. But actually, I want to bring something up because you're in your car right now, right? Now, do you know that your car, if you have a relatively modern car, actually has the equivalent of a flight data recorder, which is underneath your seat right now, that's recording how fast you're going?
How new?
Here's the story. Usually, we invent a technology to kind of help solve a problem, but then it turns into something else. When car manufacturers came up with the first generation of seatbelts, they put out a huge blast and they were hurting people. So they wanted to monitor, get information about someone who would be in an accident, and what the forces were involved, how fast the car was going, and know how the seatbelts deployed and how well they did that. So they put a little recorder underneath the seat, underneath the driver's seat, and they keep making that more capable. And so what happens now is that your driving is being recorded as you are driving, and it's making a record. Now, over time, that record will be more extensive. That is, the idea was just to get it around the time of impact, but it's getting longer and longer. Add in the fact that you've got a GPS in your car, which is telling it where you are in real time.
And a fast track when you go over the bridge.
But you start getting all this information coming together. Then we have companies like OnStar, who literally put the GPS in your car and connected it to your cell phone and were giving you this information. And when OnStar, OnStar basically has taken anybody who was a customer at one time and has sold their information on to marketers or to whoever wants to use this information. It may be selling it to insurance companies and letting the insurance companies know that you tend to drive at 90 miles an hour. So again, when we start collecting information, when we don't let people even know that there's this information collection going on, where there are no laws even telling people that their driving is being recorded by their car.
Thank you for the call. We have this show's been flying by. We've got about 3 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about two quick things, and then we'll get a few more calls in. The politics behind this. We'll talk about the relationship between Silicon Valley and Washington. The Chronicle recently had an article about political donors. So you've got people like Eric Schmidt, president of Google, giving to President Obama, Mark Andreessen, founder of Netscape, giving to Mitt Romney.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the problem is that there's so much money, and this is looked on as the hot part of the economy, and that politicians on both sides are looking toward these people for funding. And I think that given that, we're going to have a really hard time getting anything to happen in terms of protecting our privacy and our rights.
Because when President Obama, actually, he'll be here tonight. He's in San Francisco tonight, right, going to a $38,500 per plate dinner. He has no problem.
Are you invited?
Yes, although I got a discount on the ticket, and I might be able to bring a guest. You can come. He makes so much money in Silicon Valley, millions
yes.
of dollars.
Yes, because it's the most vital business in America. And so no one's questioning it because it's all successful. And no one wants to ask the questions.
The other question I wanted to ask you is about gender, because when I worked in technology, it was so male-dominated. I hear it's even worse now. There are no women on the board of Facebook, for example. It's very male-dominated.
Right.
Do you think that plays a role
here? I think
it
very much shapes the way it looks. I think there's also this kind of like Asperger's-y kind of mentality that also kind of permeates the valley as well, a computational kind of mentality.
I mean, there are very few women making any of these decisions.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it would look different, but as long as the women are not the women who are like men in order to be in those jobs, and that's the part that gets dangerous.
Well, we have time for a couple more calls. Let's hear from Fanny in Oakland. Hi, Fanny. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Two points. One is, I don't understand why people bother using the real name for most of these things. You don't need to. I have my Safeway card, Facebook thing, which I do rarely use, actually, my emails, and I just use phony names. I wouldn't think of using my real name, and for 90% of the time, that actually solves that problem. They can do whatever they want with a name that I've invented. The other thing is, I think a lot of the internet stuff is actually just an expansion of what happened when TV went from 3 channels to 500, which was basically sold to us with the idea we would have more diversity, we'd be exposed to more things. But I think the opposite has occurred. Instead of having a common set of cultural and political things that we could argue about and discuss and disagree about and even rebel against, we now have all these little niches which we can all hide in that reinforce whatever view of the world we have now, and we never have to move out of it because we can find a TV station or an internet site that totally reinforces what we currently believe.
Thank you, Fanny. We're almost out of time. Alvaro writes in, based on everything that's been said, it's already too late for privacy. And Srivenas says, Big Brother has come and it seems like we don't care enough. So we've got about a minute left.
Sure.
Your final thoughts, and where does this go from here?
Again, I think that the reason I wrote the book was to get people to be aware of what's around them. That is, that we have our the business press and the general media basically sells us technology all the time, and we only hear about the glittering success story, and we also just are attracted by all the glittering little boxes and all that. We can't resist it. I just wanted people to know that someone like myself who has been involved in it and understands it and has been involved for a long time and still loves technology, that there's another side to it and that they need to be aware of that and make decisions on what they use and how they engage with the technology that allows them to maintain some of their privacy, that allows them to be aware of what the political circumstances are.
And just 20 seconds.
Sure.
If you have one suggestion for people who are concerned about this, what should they do?
If they are concerned about it, well, first, read my book. but really, pay attention to what your kids are doing. Uh-huh. I think that's where it all starts.
That's huge, yeah. Well, thank you so much. Jason Ben-Levy is author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And thank you for your great questions and all your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. So many people choosing to live on their own. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Eric Kleinenberg, author of Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. In 1950, 4 million American adults lived alone. Today, it's 31 million. So what explains this drastic change? How has the rise in singlehood changed our society? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.